in a world plagued by greed, Limp Bizkit and Barry Manilow. One station stands alone, ejaculating a contemptuous load into the face of mainstream mediocrity. For profit, the system told them what was good. Chaos played them what they wanted to hear. This summer, if you only see one movie, we don't care, because we're a radio station. Chaos. It doesn't have to make sense.
For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. Sit here and listen to Beastie Boys all day, couldn't we? I could. Alright. Sorry, guys. Hey, it's Anti-War Radio. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I was going to start off the show by sharing with you Dr. Ron Paul's article up on antiwar.com today. It's titled "The Price of Delaying the Inevitable." But then I realized I could just have Ron tell y'all about it. So in fact, where were we about? Right here, something. Here's some more Beastie Boys for a second.
Hello, this is Ron Paul with the Good intentions frequently lead to unintended bad consequences. Tough choices, doing what is right, often leads to unanticipated good results. The growing demand by the American people for us to leave Iraq prompts the naysayers to predict disaster in the Middle East if we do. Of course, these merchants of fear are the same ones who predicted that invading and occupying Iraq would be a slam dunk operation, that we would be welcomed as liberators and oil revenues would pay the bills with minimal loss of American lives. All this hyperbole while ignoring the precise warnings by our intelligence community of the great difficulties that would lie ahead. The chaos that this preemptive undeclared war has created in Iraq has allowed the Al-Qaeda to establish a foothold in Iraq and the strategic interests of Iran to be served. The unintended consequences have been numerous. Well-intentioned but a flawed policy that ignored credible warnings of how things could go awry has produced conditions that have led to a war dominated by procrastination without victory or resolution in sight. Those who want a total military victory, which no one has yet defined, don't have the troops, the money, the equipment, or the support of a large majority of the American people to do so. Those in the Congress who have heard the cry of the electorate to end the war refuse to do so out of fear. The demagogues will challenge their patriotism and their support for the troops. So nothing happens except more of the same. The result is continued stalemate with the current policy and the daily sacrifice of American lives. This wait-and-see attitude and a promised reassessment of events in Iraq later on strongly motivates the insurgents to accelerate the killing of Americans to influence the coming decision in 3 months. In contrast, a clear decision to leave would prompt a wait-and-see attitude, a de facto ceasefire in anticipation of our leaving. The perfect time for the Iraqi factions to hold their fire on each other and on our troops and just possibly start talking with each other. Most Americans do not anticipate a military victory in Iraq, yet the Washington politicians remain frozen in their willingness to change our policy there, fearful of the dire predictions that conditions can only get worse if we leave. They refuse to admit the conditions of foreign occupation is the key ingredient that unleashed the civil war now raging in Iraq and serves as a recruiting device for Al-Qaeda. It's time for a change in our foreign policy. Thank you for calling this update at 888-322-1414. A new message is recorded every Monday, the text of which can be found on my congressional website at www.house.gov/Paul under the title in Texas Straight Talk. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're very welcome, everybody. That was, of course, Ron Paul. The number is 1-888-322-1414 to hear him read his Monday essay called The Price of Delaying the Inevitable this week up on antiwar.com. And for anybody who missed it, here's Ron Paul on The Daily Show last night.
Welcome back. My guest tonight, a Republican congressman from the state of Texas who is also running for president. Please welcome to the show Congressman Ron Paul. Congressman! Nice to see you.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. You have accomplished no small feat, which is you're running for president very much as an underdog, yet you've created a nice little buzz going about the Ron Paul candidacy. What do you attribute that to?
A good message, the philosophy of liberty. And people are still interested in being free people, living in a free country. And
hey, but you're talking about America not spreading that liberty to other areas, such as Canada and other...
No.
Right.
And I don't believe in trying to spread it. I think it's a good message, but I don't believe in spreading it with guns.
Interesting.
We should spread it by setting a good example and get others to emulate us, but not to try to force it on other people.
Which brought up, there was an interesting question, and they're very pleased. Chris Wallace asked you at the Republican debate, why are you running as a Republican? But really, it's only your Iraq message that's somewhat different maybe from all of your counterparts.
Yeah, I think that's the case, but I don't think they're very good conservatives either. You know, they talk about balancing budgets and spending less, but they don't really. But you know, the Republican Party has been known to have a position where they didn't like going overseas. You know, they didn't especially agree with Clinton on going into Kosovo and in Somalia.
Right.
So they flip-flop around. But no, I've taken a very clear position that we shouldn't have gone in.
What's so interesting about Congressman Ron Paul is you appear to have consistent, principled integrity. Americans don't usually go for that. You seem to practice what you preach. You seem to preach it consistently, even though people might disagree with the message. They certainly can't argue that you're a man of consistent principle.
Yeah, and I like to think that I've introduced a brand new idea into this campaign. I've even suggested that we follow the Constitution.
No, I'm not familiar with that document, the Constitution.
This is the thing that we sort of swear to uphold.
You know. See, I have found that the Republicans oftentimes will campaign against big government, but it seems, at least with this administration, they were against government they didn't control. But now that they control it, they find it to be very useful and expand the power of it as opposed to bring it down.
I think that's a temptation that most people yield to once they get into power. And I hope I am different, and I hope I never yield to that temptation. And so far, so good.
Now, you originally ran as a libertarian.
I ran in 88 as a libertarian candidate, but I've been in Congress for 10 terms in my 10th term, always as a Republican.
Now, why, if you ran, you said something interesting before backstage, if you ran as a libertarian, you wouldn't have gotten this platform.
No, you don't get in debates. You know, we're overseas spreading the message of democracy, but, you know, here, if you're in a third party, you have a tough time. You can't get on ballots. You spend all your time right. Getting on ballots. You have to be a Ross Perot to even get on ballots.
To have some of the bucks.
But the two parties are very much in control of the system, and they exclude individuals who aren't in that mold.
What about your domestic agenda? You know, I think you've sort of made your bones on this idea about Iraq and liberty. You're a guy that really would get rid of a lot of our government.
Yeah, I think that would be true. I think a lot of our government is very wasteful.
Right.
And
where would you go? Let's say because you won't accept as a doctor Medicare, right? Or
I never did.
Right. But you stuck to that.
Right.
Is that something you'd get rid of?
Yes, but that's not on high on my agenda. Matter of fact, we've taught a couple generations to be very dependent on government.
Right.
And that's not my goal, because I think you have to have a transition period. I happen to think that the market can deliver any service better than the government can. And my
Even,
goal...
Would you use that for defense, too, or no? You would say defense,
no
government?
No, we have defense, but this militarism isn't defense. This is opposite of defense. So I think it would be much better for the private market to deliver all.
Would you go post office? You'd stay post office.
No, I'd legalize.
You got to give the post office.
I'd legalize.
41 cents is a good deal.
No, I'd legalize competition. I mean,
right.
what the heck? Let a private firm, you know, there's FedEx and a few other those companies that do exist. I'd just legalize competition in first-class mail and let the market decide which is best.
Right. So, but doesn't that, in some respects, trust corporations over, or is that, because there's always been regulation. Are you would get rid of regulation for that as well? Or?
Yeah, and there's a big difference between corporations who benefit from government largesse. That's corporatism, and that's evil.
Right.
You know, the Halliburton stuff. And
no, I'm familiar with that.
The military industrial
complex. No, I've heard some things.
But a Bill Gates, you've
right,
heard
exactly.
Of that? How about a Bill Gates, though? He's very wealthy because we buy his services, and I think that's okay.
Right.
I don't think we should be afraid of people who make a lot of money, even in entertainment. We shouldn't be afraid of people.
No, I agree. In entertainment, I think especially in entertainment. Now, what about, you got a debate coming up.
That's right.
Tomorrow is a big debate. Anything you're going to throw out there? Any insight into the other candidates you can share? Is there anybody you find just unbelievably distasteful?
Well, ideas. I find some of their ideas very
anybody
distasteful.
You literally say, like, don't make my podium next to that guy.
No, I haven't said that yet, but I think what I'd like...
What do you think of this Romney cat? Has he talked to you?
Yeah, he said hello once.
He did?
Yeah, he did.
I don't go for him. He strikes me as the Republican John Kerry in the sense of this sort of aristocratic bearing, but playing the game of, like, Hey, look at me. I'm hunting. I'm drinking coffee. Huh?
Yeah, but he's on top of the polls. What does that mean?
What do you think that means?
That means I have to work hard and supporters out there and do a good job.
Here's what I'm going to do for you.
Okay.
Very quickly, I'm going to give you a couple of zingers for these guys for tomorrow.
Uh-oh.
So when you're out there with, okay, here you go. Here's a good one here for, let's go with Giuliani. Hey, you love the war on terror so much, why don't you marry it? Oh, wait. You'd probably then just divorce it a couple of years later. Okay. Here's one. Hey. Hey, Tommy Thompson, what's your middle name? Tom? I'll have these for you on cards if you want them.
Okay,
I'm here to help you.
Thank you. Me too. I'm here from the government, and I'm here to help you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming by, and continued success, and continued to bring excitement to the process, because I think that's what's lacking sometimes, and it's nice to see guys just throwing their ideas out there for whatever it is and being principled.
Thanks a lot.
It's nice to see you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ron. Stay right there. All right, you got to go. Ron Paul, Congressman. They all leave.
On DVD, June 5th. Oh, that was cool. Yeah, good old Ron Paul, man. I think he did a great job. That was, what do they call that in French? A coup? I'm getting on the Daily Show. And, I have to say, I'm really glad, Ron's gonna be on, the Colbert Report on, I think, the 14th of this month, June 14th. And it's not going to be, Better Know a District. It's gonna be one of those sit-down interviews, I hope. As you know, in the Better Know a District series, Colbert, man, he just clowns them the whole time. But hopefully with this sit-down interview, they'll get a little bit more accomplished. And, you know, if there was one criticism that I had, if there was one thing I could say about Ron's appearance last night on The Daily Show that didn't go exactly perfect, he should have brought his book with him. You know, all presidential campaigners have a book. Most of them have a ghostwriter to come. You know, we all remember George W. Bush's ghostwriter, the guy who said that Bush told him way back when he was the governor that the lesson they learned from the first Gulf War was to pick a small country and beat the hell out of it in order to get elected, and then you can ram through the rest of your stealing that you want to do. They almost all have ghostwriters. Of course, Hillary, it takes world communism to raise your child and all those kinds of things. Well, Ron Paul has a book called The Foreign Policy of Freedom, and it's a collection of his speeches going back to his first terms in Congress in the 1970s. And it's just excellent stuff. I recommend everybody take a look at that. And I think that would be a really good prop for Ron to bring on these TV shows. Particularly, you know, the sit-down interview shows, bring that foreign policy of freedom. Anyway, so in just a few minutes, I'll have Larissa Alexandrovna, the managing investigative news editor of RawStory.com, to talk about America's secret war in Iran, that's already begun. And in the second hour, I have tons and tons and tons of news for you, my friends. So, you just stay tuned. I'm going to play some music for you, and we'll be right back with Larissa Alexandrovna after this. We'll be right back. right, my friends. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Podcasting all these great interviews at antiwar.com. And our guest today is Larissa Alexandrovna. She's the managing investigative news editor of rawstory.com. Welcome to the show, Larissa.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Good to talk to you again. Wow, so you have this incredible report about America's secret war in Iran up on rawstory.com. We're also running it in the top headlines at antiwar.com today. The headline, CIA running black propaganda operation against Iran, Syria, and Lebanon, officials say. So tell me, what does this have to do with the finding that Brian Ross reported at ABC News a couple of weeks ago, authorizing the CIA to intervene in Iran?
Well, a part of the Ross report was that it got, well, at least according to my own sources, it got some basic things wrong in that there was no single recent presidential finding. A presidential finding is like a directive, and it's official, and Congress has oversight. And it applies to covert activities that the CIA engages in. So the Ross report basically indicated that there was this new presidential finding empowering the CIA to pursue a non-lethal covert operation inside Iran and against Iran. And part of my article clarifies, at least through my own investigation, some of the issues raised by Ross's article. One of those issues is that there was no single recent finding. Rather, there was at least two that my sources are aware of over the last couple of years that empowered the CIA to conduct really kind of a fairly, you know, open covert propaganda war, if you will, because it's kind of like the open secret that no one talks about. It's not so aggressive. So in terms of covert, it's not as covert as one would think. And they're mainly dealing with mainstream groups, you know, those quote-unquote pro-Iranian democracy groups. So that's one issue. The second issue is that it's not as aggressive as the Ross report suggests, and that it's not limited to Iran. Rather, it's targeting Syria and Lebanon and organizations such as Hezbollah. And essentially, it is strictly almost a black propaganda, meaning that it's putting out information that appears to be from other sources that reflects negatively on these various countries and organizations. And beyond that, I don't have the specifics. So that's one element of the story. The other issue is that the real covert ops, the hardcore, really aggressive, you know, Iran-Contra kind of activities, are actually running out of the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the thing that everyone's ignoring, and that is the thing that has no finding and has no congressional oversight. So that's the basic gist of the article.
Okay. Well, let's put off the military end of this for a minute here and stick with the CIA.
Okay.
It sounds like black propaganda operation. Isn't that the kind of thing we'd be expecting them to do every day of the week? I imagine, you know, guys in trench coats and shadows and cloaks and daggers and assassinations. This sounds pretty tame.
The CIA has been largely stripped of a lot of its power in this administration.
So this is all they got left, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's no secret that the neoconservatives do not like the agency. And, you know, with good reason, also, obviously. I mean, I think wherever there's secrecy, there's concern. But at the same time, I think that the people from the Iran-Contra days who are now in our government, such as Elliot Abrams and those folks, they learned a valuable lesson about how to run how to bypass Congress and run their own kind of shop. What they did was they basically buried everything in defense, in the Defense Department, which has, which can claim, military, standard military operations, and does not have to report these various things to Congress because there's a loophole in the law regarding covert activities that kind of, there's a gray area that isn't addressed, and they're exploiting that gray area.
Mm-hmm. And now, as you said before, if the president signs a finding ordering the CIA to do this kind of stuff, that has to be turned right over to the Senate Intelligence Committee and so forth.
But, and the House Intelligence Committee, correct.
Uh-huh, but if they order the Defense Department to undergo one of these things, there's nothing in the law that mandates that they inform the Intelligence Committees, the Armed Services Committees, or anybody else.
Right. So technically it's not illegal, but, you know, technically, non-technically it is illegal because it's a loophole that basically violates the standard operational procedures of how covert information or covert activities are conducted. This, and I'm not talking about the standard advanced teams that the military uses or reconnaissance or things of that nature, because that is standard military ops. I'm talking about what is traditionally seen as CIA territory, which would require oversight, such as the use of proxy groups, terrorist groups, using them as proxies for our own purposes. That kind of activity is generally CIA type of activity, not DOD. And so to avoid oversight, it's been put into DOD. So the CIA really is running, for all intents and purposes, a fairly, as you said, tame operation that isn't new and isn't this aggressive thing. There is one element to it, though, where there's some confusion, and that has to do with the economic pressure or economic warfare element that is part of this. These findings. Basically, there's been pressure to disengage Western countries and interests from Iran in order to stifle their economy. And so part of that could and likely does fall under CIA in terms of, under the propaganda element or the PSYOPs element, whatnot.
How successful is that likely to be? It seems like...
Very successful. Very successful in terms of, our efforts, but is it going to stifle Iran's economy? No, because Iran's fairly self-sufficient. So.
Well, and is it even going to stifle Western investment in their economy? I remember I talked with Greg Palast a few weeks back, and he said British Petroleum, I think it was, just finished building a massive multi-billion dollar refinery in Iran. They're not going anywhere, and their subsidiary company, the Royal Air Force, is not going to go anywhere near it.
Right, but on the flip side, you've got Halliburton, who's exited, where you've got other interests that need financing, and you've got European banks or international banks not providing the financing or the line of credit. Things like that. So that's that's still fairly tame. But there's a darker element to the economic stuff that nobody knows who's doing. And my sort of sense of this is, because no one can tell me because that would be classified, but my sense of just from talking to people is that it's not the agency that's doing it, is that there is actually a physical covert kind of more tangible and, some might say violent activities going on where supply convoys are being intercepted and there's subterfuge going on in terms of, delivery of machines or supplies needed for a project or so if there's a company that isn't pulling out, they're kind of being pushed out through these various more aggressive methods. And my understanding is that, at least just my take on it, is that this isn't part of the economic, warfare, or I'm not even sure what to call this type of thing, that's part of the CIA finding, that it seems to fall outside of that, And, who's running it, we don't know, but, you know, my gut tells me that, you know, it's likely that defense is likely running that off. So, it's complicated, but for some reason, the ABC article sparked a huge wave of concern, when the real concern should be about the DOD operations that are going on.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, Gareth Porter, who's a great reporter, came on this show and said that his sense was that the leak to Brian Ross probably came from Dick Cheney's office,
right.
In order to thwart Rice's attempted negotiations.
Actually, that's interesting that you say that, because one of my sources, although not saying, not mentioning the Rice element, said that they believed that it was a planted story out of the OVP because of how misleading it is. I mean, the fact is that if you're already going to get information about covert activity, the basics of that information, that is to say the key things that you're given that aren't classified but are in the gray area but are the key pieces of your story, should be right. So the fact that there's this new finding and that it's this aggressive war and all this stuff, you know, these basic parts of the story that are wrong, and that's really essentially the whole story, would suggest that either someone doesn't know what they're talking about, which I doubt, given the stature of the reporter, or that the reporter was used by, as this administration does often, to launder their talking points and their policy things by, making the public argument through proxies.
Mm-hmm.
It's their own version of propaganda warfare, you know?
Right. Well, and as you said, though, this is the one that made all the news, even though for those of us with eyes and ears, Seymour Hersh reported that more than 2 years ago in his article, The Coming Wars, that
right.
the DOD had taken over, had wrested control of covert operations away from the CIA, was in Iran on the ground killing people.
Well, I mean, I don't know if...
Didn't he?
He didn't say on the ground killing people. I think I'd remember that.
Well, at least on the ground, and I remember him saying that there were regular army, not just special forces, but regular army troops on the ground in Iran, too.
I know there are special forces. That I know. But there are several different groups. Just like before the Iraq War, there were the real groups, you know, the official covert groups, the joint task forces and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And then the black off-book kind of groups that nobody knew who the hell they were working for, that literally would bump into our official covert groups. And, these guys would be like, who are you? Why are you here? You know? I've simply started calling them the ghost teams. And if you remember, I did an article a while back, at least one of these teams, it was a four-man team that was running around Iraq claiming to be with, special forces and such and claiming to be with a particular task force, even though they weren't. And they were clearly American, and nobody knew who they were working for.
Well, and didn't it turn out that they were working for the policy department at the DOD?
Well, the allegation is, and there's no way to prove this, but the allegation was the OSP was running their own little, military ops that bypassed all standard channels of covert ops. Even covert ops have their own standard ways of being handled and such. So, I mean, this bypassed everything and kind of was its own operation. So, it's really bizarre, and I don't know if they're on the ground killing people, but there are definitely groups on the ground. There are the official covert op task forces doing things on the ground. That's true. And then there's this ghost team. I don't know if it's the same team that was running around before as we went into Iraq. But there's also that team, and that secondary team is the team that's running around with training and also training groups like the MEK and others to mm-hmm. act as intelligence agents, despite the fact that these groups are in the, you know, continuing to commit acts of terrorism.
Well, I want to ask you all about those groups, but first I want to ask you what all that background noise is, and is there anything you can do about it?
Well, if you want to call me back, I can try a different phone.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it sounds like you're rolling marbles in the background or something. I guess it's not too bad.
Yeah, well, actually, you caught me. I'm rolling marbles. I apologize. It's my phone.
Oh, well, no, don't worry about it. It's really
not that bad. I have another phone I can try. But.
It's not too bad. Anyway, so let's go on with these groups, the MEK. That's the Mujahideen Al-Qaq. Who are they, and what's their history? And they, you say they work for the DOD now?
No, I mean, they don't officially work for the DOD. You know, that's the statement that would require hardcore, you know, documentation. But they're being run, as in used by DOD assets. So, that's the best way I can explain it. They're basically a terrorist organization. They're a separatist group that's started off as kind of a communist, kind of pro-communist group, and has, you know, come full circle and ended up being, extreme right wing. Some have described them as, you know, a cult. There's bizarre kind of cult element to them. In any case, in Saddam's Iraq, he had given them free, kind of, you know, free entry into his country. And they acted as his domestic police in a lot of instances. And then they continued doing their, you know, terrorist activities. When we came into Iraq, we basically took away all of their big weapons and such, but we left them with the training camp that Saddam had given them, and we left them with all of their munitions and smaller arms. And there are allegations that we have trained some of them to go into Iran and conduct reconnaissance and surveillance, and there are some allegations also saying that we've used them to conduct acts of violence and, bombings and such.
And there have been reports of bombings and so forth in Iran. Is there no hard evidence of who's behind them?
Well, I mean, hard evidence would require an independent investigation, and, there's plenty of people on both sides saying, no, yes and no. On one hand, you've got some European folks, sources both on and off the record, and the Iranian government and others saying, yes, it is them, the people the few people that we've arrested are, in fact, MEK and others. Actually, there's other smaller groups. And then you've got, U.S. saying, no, we're not doing this, and we would never do this. You've got Britain saying we would never support anything like this. Without a real investigation, it's hard to say. But the evidence does suggest, at least to me and to the people I've spoken with, that it is MEK who's at the very least was responsible for the assassination of 22 various kind of lower-level government officials in Iran up until last March. And then it sort of all went radio silent, and there hasn't been a lot of activity attributed to them in the region. It seems to have moved to other groups mm-hmm. and such. But the other problem with MEK, though, is that aside from being a terrorist group and on the State Department's terrorist list, they have a lobby in D.C. I know this because they've contacted me, in the past to say that I was very wrong about their organization.
Well, Scott Ritter says in his book Target Iran that their lobby here in America is basically a front for Israeli intelligence.
I don't know about that. I'm more likely to. Well, he might know better than I. I mean,
at least he makes the case that numerous times when they came forward with new information about Iran, that they'd really gotten it from Israel, that they were, the information was being washed through them.
I'd be careful to kind of separate what I'm hearing, and this is actually a follow-up piece I'm doing, so I'm going to try to not say too much, but my understanding is that the AIPAC, you know, lobby and groups like AIPAC, JINSA, and all of those groups have sort of taken their own path away from even the Likudniks in Israel. And there seems to be a lot of tension because it's almost like there's different agendas here. So why I can on one hand understand that there seems to be Israeli intelligence coming in through, or what's claimed to be Israeli intelligence, coming out of the MEK-DC lobby. I don't think it's coming from Israeli intelligence proper. I think it's likely coming from AIPAC.
And this is something we've seen kind of over and over, that the neocons are even more warlike than the right wing in Israel. Last summer, they tried to get Israel to bomb Syria, and they said, go to hell.
Right. I mean, the AIPAC lobby and other lobbies like it, they may have started out representing Israeli interests, but they, just like, you know, Cheney doesn't represent Republican interests anymore, or Bush doesn't, you know. You can't, anyone who's really a Republican can't possibly look at this administration and call them Republicans. And so you, by the same token, you've got these people who may have started off representing Israel, but they have since, over a period of time, sort of merged with interests in the United States, and there's a lot of friction over that. And
military-industrial interests.
Yeah, I think that's a really great way of putting it. And I think that the MEK intelligence laundry, essentially, is not coming from Israeli intelligence. Rather, Israeli intelligence is very good about not leaking. In fact, out of all the intelligence organizations, I would say, on the planet, they are probably the best, most well-organized, most efficient intelligence agency, the Mossad. And my guess is this is coming from AIPAC and not Israel proper. Just like the neocons are doing their own thing that has nothing to do with the United States, real, you know, the interests of the people in the United States or even our government. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but anyway, they have a D.C. lobby, and despite being on the terrorist watch list or the terrorist list at the State Department, they have a lobby, and they can call reporters like me and tell me that I'm wrong about them. You see, I can only imagine maybe Al-Qaeda will have a lobby next. You know,
yeah, I think they might already have one.
It's possible.
In the form of the Oval Office seems to, the indispensable ally is what they call it.
Yeah, no, I think that they're likely running out of the Saudi embassy, but I'm just joking.
Yeah,
anyway.
No, me too. Okay, so what about Jundullah? Am I saying that right? What kind of terrorist group is this?
Yeah, this is Cy Hirst reported about this. This is a Pakistani kind of like an Al-Qaeda offshoot. But it's not just MEK and them. It's also PKK, which is, you know, a lot of Kurdish separatists, Baluchi separatists. Basically, they're dissident groups. Normally, the use of these groups in any way, or whether using them as eyes and ears on the ground or whatever, all of that stuff generally falls to the agency. And under this administration, it's been running out of the Defense Department. I might add, the civilian leadership of the Defense Department, who has no clue what they're dealing with. And so I think we're going to have a lot of blowback, that's for sure. But back to tie this up back to the article, basically none of that, these covert ops, the Defense Department is running, even without the permission of the Defense Department. I mean, these things are running out of, you know, a cabal's office. You know, a little group of people are running this, and the rest of the DOD doesn't even know about it.
Right. Well, isn't this what Seymour Hersh said in his last article, that Elliot Abrams had a little party of all the veterans of Iran-Contra, and they decided
they did lessons learned, yeah.
Right, right. And the lessons learned were you want to keep this thing isolated to the vice president's office and maybe a couple of people on the National Security Council, and that's it.
Well, I would add to that.
Run it all through the military. Keep
exactly.
the CIA
I would
completely
add to that, at least the way my sources have explained it to me, is what they learned from, I don't know if my sources said nothing about this, lessons learned, but I wouldn't doubt it, given Elliot Abrams. My under, you know, but that, yeah, these guys basically knew that if they used agency resources or officers, then there would have to be some congressional oversight. And if they try to bypass Congress, then it would, you know, result in massive, you know, investigations and this and that. So they buried it under DOD in the so-called standard military operations, which they're not. And I might add that the Congress has tried to look into these issues, but the DOD has said, look, these are, you know, standard military operations, and they're, you know, the president has to make these decisions quickly. They can't wait for he can't wait for congressional approval when you've got men, you know, our soldiers are on the ground, military on the ground. So essentially they're using that argument to keep, you know, Congress from asking questions of these, of the military.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think they likely did have a lessons learned party, and then they're running this very well this time around. It is, in fact, being driven out of the OVP, guided by the NSC, and run out of a small cabal out of DOD. Oh, and with, you know, a small laundry facility in State Department under Lizzie Cheney's office, which has now been disbanded.
Oh, what can you tell me about that? A laundry running out of there? Is that what he said?
Well, I mean, it's a democracy fund that she was handling, mm-hmm. you know.
And this is the black ops money?
No, she had her own black ops money. Hmm. There's the $50 million or so that Congress approved that went for the CIA ops, and it was split evenly between a democracy fund and this propaganda kind of outfit. Mm-hmm. And then there's money that's at state and other money that I don't even know where we got it, how we got it. It's not money that is appropriated in on the record, as it were. But anyway, she had this little fund where she was, you know, helping to spread the message of democracy. Lizzie Cheney, who has no experience in anything other than, you know, being the daughter of the vice president. Mm-hmm. So she was heading up this thing, this running of this project, and basically without any congressional oversight either, and nobody knows what went on over there, or what the money was used for, or if state was handling MEK, you know, as a go-between between DOD and whatnot. I mean, we've got, you know, this has become so corrupt that we really don't know who's doing what, under whose authority, under whose supervision, and it's almost like a little family affair, you know.
I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Larissa Alexandrovna. She's the managing investigative news editor of RawStory.com, and we're talking about her new article for Raw Story, CIA Running Black Propaganda Operation Against Iran, Syria, Lebanon. Officials say. Now, let's talk about the Syria-Lebanon angle here. Is this just the CIA propaganda move, or is the DOD involved in covert operations in these countries as well?
In what countries?
In Syria and Lebanon.
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, but not as... Let's just say that, and because I'm doing this in another article, I have to be careful what I say here, but let's say that there are other intermediaries, there are other nations or representatives of nations that are acting as intermediaries.
The Saudis.
You could say that.
Prince Bandar. Well, and we've seen the fruits of this in Lebanon already, I suppose.
Yeah.
Hirsch
in Syria,
reported that,
actually.
And in Syria. Well, tell me Syria in a second.
I can't, because it's my next article.
Okay.
Don't go there.
Well, I'll tell them Lebanon then. America, according to Seymour Hirsch, through Saudi Arabia, was supporting the Fatah al-Islam group and using the puppet Sinora government in Lebanon to do so. And within just a few months, this group that we're funding in order to fight Hezbollah was fighting side by side with Hezbollah against the Lebanese government.
Right.
Talk about blowback.
Well, I wouldn't even call that blowback. I would call that treason, because this is that's not the only thing that's going on. I mean, you have, and I, again, I can't we're talking outside of the realm of this particular article that I just wrote and getting into one that I'm about to write. So I'm trying to kind of, stay...
Okay, well, tell me what you can.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what I can say is you have to kind of look at another really big issue, and that is the U.S. supplying the Gulf states with weapons.
Mm-hmm, the Patriot missile batteries and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And you have, that I think is a good question to ask. Where are those weapons going?
Well, where are they going, if not just to the Gulf states?
That's a good question. You'll have to read about it later.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, and that brings up the question of hot war and whether we're going to have a full-scale bombing war. There's some dichotomies floating around that I'm not certain if they're false ones or not. There are some who say that the black ops is an alternative to full-scale war, that Bush was told, I forget what's his name, wrote this in on Time Magazine's blog, that the Joint Chiefs had told Bush, you can't invade Iran, do a bombing run from the air without causing major problems. And so Bush had then decided on Plan B, all this covert operation stuff.
Hang on.
There's another one that says that Rice is kind of in a faction fight with Dick Cheney, and she wants to negotiate the uranium enrichment away, and he wants to bomb it, and she's trying to stave it off, although that could easily be seen as just she's creating the path for him later. Those are a couple of dichotomies that are floating around. Help set us straight, Larissa.
Well, okay, I'll set you straight.
Set me straight, do that.
Okay. There was no either or in terms of let's do the military strike, and if not, let's do then a covert war. We were already doing the covert war, and we were, when I say we, I should really be very specific in terms of who we are, and that would be the OVP and the connections at the Defense Department. Whether or not the president was fully made aware of this or was involved in this or made any decisions around this, I don't know. Nobody does, and that's kind of scary. But then you have the official findings, which empowers the CIA to do, like black propaganda and stuff like that, that indicate that the president apparently thinks this is, we're just starting this kind of effort. So it would support the theory that the OVP is running largely on its own in terms of foreign policy. There was always a plan for regime change. It has nothing to do with the uranium, nothing, in terms of the OVP. It was always regime change. If they weren't enriching uranium, there would be a whole other issue that would be, sold to us as the reason. So the plan for regime change was always there, and the OVP side of things was going forward with that no matter what diplomatic efforts we were taking. So in that context, Cheney and Rice were butting heads. That's true. Rice, on the other hand, is pursuing basically a resolution of a problem, and that is uranium enrichment that has nothing to do with the regime change policy being pursued by the other side.
And we know that the uranium is simply an excuse here.
Right, and even if Rice, let's say, succeeds, it doesn't change the policy on the other side. So we're, it's almost like they're working... Rice is trying to resolve an issue that the OVP is essentially exploiting for their own purposes, and that is regime change. In terms of is there going to be an actual, all-out war, there was supposed to be, and it kept moving back for various reasons, some of which had to do with journalists exposing some of the stuff that was going on. So, things had to be changed. Some of it had to do with other things going on, like Iraq falling apart and things of that nature. So where we are now is there is a sort of a feeling that what the OVP side of things might do is strengthen the covert wars much and conduct them in much the same way like they did with Nicaragua in the 80s. where they're literally conducting a full-scale war that isn't declared and isn't acknowledged. So it, instead of airstrikes, they would do, you know, more aggressive things, but under, you know, not under our own flag and not under our own official resources. That's the current climate, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about Steve Clemens' report that Cheney was basically shopping around? Well, he corrected me. He was shopping it around in very limited places at AEI, basically sending his lackeys to tell people, apparently, that if George Bush won't get his act together and bomb Iran, that he's going to try to get Israel to start it by shooting some cruise missiles and get Iran to strike our assets in the Gulf, and then Bush will have to fight the war.
Well, first of all, Clemens is very good. He has a lot of connections. He knows what he's talking about. And yes, it's true that the OVP is running its own shop separate from that of the presidency and separate from presidential directives. So that essentially you could say that the OVP has, there's been a coup and no one's told the president yet.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good way to put it.
Right, exactly. And so he really should be arrested, because no matter what you think of George Bush's policies, the fact is that, you know, under the rule of law, he is the president. And if Cheney wants to have his own little thing on the side, that's illegal. But back to this particular point, I know that the Cheney and the Saudis are working closely. That's no surprise to anyone, I would think. What my understanding is that Israel is not going along with the project. And this goes back to what I said before about AIPAC and Israel's almost going their separate ways, where you've got American corporate political kind of interests that's becoming more dominant within the lobby than the original reason for its creation. So it's working counter to its own government, and as is the OVP counter to our own government.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say Netanyahu's next.
Netanyahu's next what?
To be prime minister again.
Netanyahu, in fact, is trying to stop a full-scale military op, is what I'm told.
Really?
Yeah. He's saying, okay, you have your covert stuff that you're doing, and he knows what's going on over there. Let's give that some time, because he wants these guys out of office. He does want regime change in Iran, but he doesn't want these guys in charge of it. So, like I said, there's a lot of different – it's not as cut and dry as, okay, you know, Cheney's going to get Israel to do this, and then we're going to do that. It's not that easy, because you're talking about – there's differences now where AIPAC no longer speaks for Israel, and Israel no longer, you know, is that fond of AIPAC. Cheney can run around and say everything he wants to, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I'm more inclined to think that Saudi assets would perhaps be more helpful and probably more likely used for an operation such as the one you described, and, for example, Israeli assets. The Saudis have much more at stake here. You know, Israel can wait this out. Saudis can't.
What is it that the Saudis have at stake here? Iranian domination of Iraqi and Iranian oil resources?
And the lack of their own supplies. I mean, they have... On top of that, the Iranian market, you know, is partnering up with the biggest markets. And, you know, you've got Russia, China, Venezuela. The Saudi oil cartel is literally losing its power, and with it, its money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're more worried about that element. And certainly...
Well, now, there were negotiations taking place, too, right? I remember... Not too long ago, maybe 6 weeks ago or so, Saudis go into Iran to have meetings and talk peace. Was that just for show on TV?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what anybody talked about. I don't know. It's possible they were negotiating a cut of the profits. But the other Saudi concern is that, you know, a strong theocratic Iran, you know, with a good economy and where the people have money, unlike Saudi Arabia, where the royals have all the money, will topple them, will inspire their own people to topple the royals. So, you know, I think this is more pressing to Saudi Arabia right now than it is to Israel. Israel is, what I'm being told, is very nervous.
Well, this whole clean break strategy has been a disaster for Israel. I mean, it's
right.
It's pretty clear that the neocons were wrong, that that's not how to get along in the neighborhood, by bullying and dominating everybody.
I'm starting to wonder just who the neocons were representing, whose interests in this policy. It's not U.S. interests. It's not, I mean, you could say, sure, it was a really bad idea, but, I mean, it would have to be so bad on so many levels that, you know, for it to be so bad, it can't just be a bad idea. It's like it wasn't meant to serve U.S. interests. It wasn't meant to serve Israeli interests. It was meant to serve corporate interests, really.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder whether Bush and Cheney are KGB.
No, they're not KGB.
Oh, well, that was a joke, but... But same principle.
Well, no,
I mean, what
so
you're talking about is you're talking about people acting exactly contrary to their country's interests, and you got to try to figure out some sort of reasonable explanation for it.
Well, not if you have people who believe that their country's corporate interests are the same thing as their country's interests.
Uh huh. Yeah. Well, that's a very good point. Now, let me ask you one more thing. I'm already over time here, Larissa, but I got an email this morning from a guy who says he watches the websites that track Navy assets and that the USS Eisenhower carrier strike group is back in Norfolk, Virginia, that there are only two now in the Persian Gulf area, that apparently Admiral Fallon's decision to refuse to request a third one or something along those lines worked out. Do you have any information about that, the Ike back in Virginia?
No, I don't, actually. I've been looking for a while on assignment at the story we were just discussing, so I haven't even looked there. But it'd be interesting. I know that, you know, that there was a lot of, recently there was a lot of activity as we were trying to, show off our muscles and strength and all of that. But I don't know how many carrier groups that entailed.
Mm-hmm. We, again, meaning Vice President Cheney and the wimps in his office.
Yeah, people who never went to war or... right, exactly.
Or even
that's
ever
exactly
grew a whisker
right
on their face or been in a fist fight or anything.
Right, exactly. The overprivileged people who are more than happy to send everyone else's children to die. Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, the desk murderers.
Yeah. What?
The desk murderers.
Instead of the pencil pushers?
Yeah, well, I think, where am I plagiarizing that from? I think Chalmers Johnson in his new book, Nemesis, calls them the desk murderers, which is actually from the Holocaust, where I think it was the Eichmann trial. I forget which. I think it was the Eichmann trial, where they determined that the further away you are from the torture, the more guilty you are, you son of a bitch. You know, assuming you were in on the chain of command and signed a piece of paper or something, that you're just as guilty or even more guilty of the torture than the people who actually did it with their hands, as you sat
yeah,
at your desk and ordered it.
That also goes hand in hand with the further you are, the easier it is to do, because you don't have to witness firsthand the suffering or the losses or anything.
Right.
So when you have people who've never served in the military, who've never, you know, been covert other than, you know, conducting maybe criminal things, and they're outing CIA officers and they're planting stories about CIA programs that have, you know, are in comparison to what the DOD is doing, you know, might as well be called Bromper Room, when they're using the very people who attacked us on 9/11 to further their own interests. I mean, we've got a serious problem, and somehow Congress has just, you know, abdicated. I don't know where Congress is.
Well, they don't read The New Yorker, I guess.
Oh,
Raw
I think
story.
They read The New Yorker. I just think they haven't read the Constitution. Maybe they should try reading that for a change.
Yeah, that might be it. All right, well, we're going to move on. Thank you very much for your time today, Larissa.
Absolutely, no problem.
Really appreciate it, everybody. Larissa Alexandrovna, she's the managing investigative news editor at rawstory.com. The article today, CIA running black propaganda operation against Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas, and we'll be right back. Folks, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This is Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Warning, the following may be a whitewash. June 3rd, 2007, New York Times by Scott Shane. Soviet-style torture becomes interrogation. How did the United States, in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, come to adopt interrogation techniques copied from the Soviet Union and other Cold War adversaries? Investigators for the Senate Armed Services Committee are examining how the methods, long used to train Americans for what they may face as prisoners of war, became the basis for American interrogations. Flashback 2 or 3 years, Miss Shauna Kay on this very show, well, on the Chaos Report, explained this very fact. In 2002, the CIA and the Pentagon became concerned that standard questioning was inadequate for suspected terrorists and turned to a military training program called Survival, Evasion, Reconnaissance, and Escape, or SEER. For decades, SEER trainers had exposed aviators and others at high risk for capture to Soviet-style tactics, including disrupted sleep, exposure to extreme heat and cold, and hours in uncomfortable stress positions. Sometimes the ordeal included waterboarding, in which a prisoner's face is covered with cloth and water is poured from above to create a feeling of suffocation. Some of those techniques have been used on prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and in Afghanistan and Iraq and at the CIA's secret overseas jails for high-level operatives of Al-Qaeda. Many SEER veterans were appalled at the, quote, reverse engineering of their methods, said Charles A. Morgan III, a Yale psychiatrist who has worked closely with SEER trainers for a decade. Quote, how did something used as an example of what an unethical government would do become something we do, he asked. His question is only underscored by a 1956 article, Communist Interrogation, in the Annals of Neurology and Psychiatry, recently turned up by the Intelligence Science Board, which advises the spy agencies, written by doctors working as Defense Department consultants, Lawrence E. Hinkle Jr. and Harold G. Wolfe. The article shows that methods embraced after 2001 were once considered torture that would produce false information. The article describes basic Soviet NKVD, later KGB, methods. Isolation in a small cell, constant light, sleep deprivation, cold or heat, reduced food rations. Soviets denied such treatment was torture, just as American officials have in recent years. Okay, so folks, what you're about to hear is from a 1956 article, Communist Interrogation, in the Annals of Neurology and Psychiatry. The effects of isolation, anxiety, fatigue, lack of sleep, uncomfortable temperatures, and chronic hunger produce disturbances of mood, attitudes, and behavior in nearly all prisoners. The living organism cannot entirely withstand such assaults. The communists, Republicans, do not look upon these assaults as torture, but all of them produce great discomfort and lead to serious disturbances of many bodily processes. There is no reason to differentiate them from any other form of torture. Interrogators look for ways to increase the pressure, including stress positions. Another technique widely used is that of requiring the prisoner to stand throughout the interrogation session or to maintain some other physical position, which becomes painful. This, like other features of the KGB, CIA, procedure, is a form of physical torture, in spite of the fact that the prisoners and KGB officers alike do not ordinarily perceive it as such. Any fixed position, which is maintained over a long period of time, ultimately produces excruciating pain. Overt brutality was discouraged, as it is at American facilities. Again, quoting from this 1956 article about how the communists torture people, the KGB hardly ever uses manacles or chains and rarely resorts to physical beatings. The actual physical beating is, of course, repugnant to overt communist principles and is contrary to KGB regulations. And boy, didn't Andrew Sullivan just get this right on his blog? He just crossed out KGB and put U.S. military there, CIA there, Republican principles in the place of communist ones, so that very same paragraph reads, The military, or CIA, hardly ever uses manacles or chains and rarely resorts to physical beatings. The actual physical beating is, of course, repugnant to overt Republican principles and is contrary to CIA regulations. Closed trials and military tribunals were standard under the communist Soviet Union, as at Guantanamo. Quoting again from this 1956 article, prisoners are tried before military tribunals, which are not public courts. Those present are only the interrogator, the state prosecutor, the prisoner, the judges, a few stenographers, and perhaps a few officers of the court. The Bush administration concluded that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to Al-Qaeda detainees. Similarly, the Soviets argued that international rules did not apply to foreign detainees. In typical communist legalistic fashion, the NKVD, in typical Republican legalistic fashion, the CIA rationalized its use of torture and pressure in the interrogation of prisoners of war. When it desired to use such methods against a prisoner to obtain from him a propaganda statement or confession, it simply declared the prisoner a war crime suspect, now, of course, enemy combatant, same thing, and informed him that, therefore, he was not subject to international rules governing the treatment of prisoners of war. Communist-style interrogation routinely produced false confessions. Again, reading from this 1956 manual written by Americans about the USSR and how they torture people, the cumulative effects of the entire experience may be almost intolerable. The prisoner becomes mentally dull and loses his capacity for discrimination. He becomes malleable and suggestible, and in some instances he may confabulate, that is, make stuff up for his torturer. By suggesting that a prisoner accept half-truths and plausible distortions of the truth, the interrogator makes it possible for the prisoner to rationalize and thus accept the interrogator's viewpoint as the only way out of an intolerable situation. I warned you, that very well could be just simply a whitewash. I'm afraid it is. It's gotten a bit of press on Democracy Now! On the Chaos Report here on Chaos Radio in Austin. And now again in the New York Times. Not just is this American manual explaining how the communists torture people an exact corollary to current American procedure, but they tell this story that the reason that American torture techniques are just like the Soviet ones is because they took their look, you might get tortured and this is what they're likely to do to you, so we're going to go ahead and you know, prepare you, but don't worry, you can tap out if it really comes down to it, kind of thing, right? And that these, how you might be tortured by the Soviets if you're caught, training sessions, that these very techniques were then used as the torture techniques under Operation Copper Green and Bush's war against individual liberty. I'm not so certain that's true. In fact, I'm fairly convinced that that is a whitewash of the truth, my friends. I have here a book which I'm not finished yet, but hopefully we'll get finished with sometime this week, called The Question of Torture by Alfred McCoy, the same guy that wrote The Politics of Heroin back in the day. And it's all about how these torture techniques don't so much come from the Soviets as they come from the Nazis. And he tells the story about how the CIA and the military and the United States government perfected no-touch torture dating way back to the 1950s. And in fact, their excuse then was that the Soviets were way ahead of them and they had to catch up. So maybe this is... you know, they use these Nazi tactics in order to counter Soviet ones. But in any case, here we are in the United States of America, where the New York Times can reprint a manual written by Americans about those sicko commie bastards and how they torture people. That is literally could be a word-for-word description of how America does it. Is that why we won the Cold War, so that we could become the Soviet Union? Won the Cold War. Is that why our government spent trillions of dollars opposing the Soviet Union all those years? Just to turn us into Soviet citizens here? To turn our country into the kind of place where people torture? And somebody wrote on my blog the other day, all Ron Paul's really got to do in the debate, which, by the way, that'll be tonight on CNN, don't miss it, is get up there and say, how the hell is it that in the United States of America, we're sitting here a bunch of presidential candidates debating torture? Torture. You know, you can only give up so much of your heritage of liberty and due process and so forth before it just doesn't exist anymore. You know, before you're on a track straight down to the bottom of the hill and won't be able to get your liberty back for some other extended period of time, you know? We're talking about the very basic principles of what American society, how American society supposedly defines itself. Liberty and justice for all. Fair trials for everyone. If you're being accused and the state is threatening with locking you in a cage away from everyone else, or even to tie you down to the chair and stick the needle in your arm and kill you, you have to have the right to defend yourself, to face your accusers, to be protected from cruel and unusual punishment that might force you to admit to things that you didn't really do, as we've seen over and over again. I mean, Abu Ali right now is in an American prison for a plot to kill George Bush that never existed. He was pulled out of school by the Saudis and tortured in the presence of the FBI into quote-unquote admitting that he was going to kill George Bush, you know, just as soon as he got out of school and came back to America where he's from. And the judge let all the evidence, quote-unquote, in that he had confessed, and yet refused to allow the jury to know that, yeah, this confession was obtained by the Saudis. And under conditions of torture, they weren't allowed to know that. And that was in a criminal trial. That wasn't even a guy who was, you know, treated as an enemy combatant in a military tribunal. That was in a criminal trial in America. Yes, torture evidence is admissible. The fact that it was gained by torture is not. In the case of Abu Ali. The fact that that's where we are in this country, you know, I don't really think it should matter where you're from or who you are or what you believe in or how rich or poor or what color your skin might be or whether you've been an American for a year or your whole life long. Is that what we want for our country to be, the land of torture? You know, for foreigners, when they think of America, to picture Abu Ghraib instead of the Statue of Liberty. And, you know, what the hell, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and say there's never been torture in American history. There has, but damn, you know, what was good about us was our insistence on not letting it be that way to the very best of our ability. Hell, they only let Hamilton and Madison have this Constitution on the promise that they would add a Bill of Rights modeled on what George Mason had written for the Bill of Rights in Virginia. Or whatever it was called. I guess it was Jefferson that wrote the Bill of Rights for Virginia. I forgot what it was George Mason had written. But anyway, doesn't matter. What matters is the federal government is barred forever by the Eighth Amendment from torturing anyone. It's barred forever from performing searches on Americans or anyone inside the United States of America without a judicial warrant based on a sworn statement, particularly describing the places to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. They are forbidden forever by the Fifth Amendment from depriving anyone of their life, liberty, or property without due process, without the rest of the Bill of Rights, without, you know, the rest of the Fifth Amendment itself and all the other laws enforcing those provisions. It is illegal for our government to torture people. Romney and Giuliani and all of those Republicans, I guess, except McCain and Paul, ought to be immediately barred. You can't be the president. You're already on the record pro-torture. You're out of here. And McCain he's on thin ice himself. He you know, accepted the compromise Military Commissions Act, which basically legalizes torture, leaves it up to the president to decide what's torture and what isn't. So how is that? How does that make John McCain the anti-torture senator? Torture in America. Torture by America. What the hell? And, you know, I feel stupid even having to say, but I guess I have to say, that ticking time bomb scenario is bullshit. It never happens that way, ever. This is not the Kiefer Sutherland, screw the law, I'm going to do what I want hour. You know, show me a single time ever outside of an episode of Batman or 24 that there was a ticking time bomb where somebody had to be tortured in order to get the information in time to save a bunch of innocent people. Show me a single time. You know, never mind even in the recent history of anti-Western terrorism. Show me a single time ever. You know, mobsters in Chicago, left-wing radicals. Show me a time ever that there was a ticking time bomb that resorting to torture is what saved the day. Ever. Outside of fiction. As though that would excuse it. As though that would make it perfectly okay. You know, it's a good thing I'm not a collectivist, because or else I would have to buy into all that. You know, I'm ashamed of myself and my country and blah, blah, wah. But I'm anti-torture, and I always have been, and so I don't have any reason to be ashamed or sorry. I don't accept collective guilt on the part of my neighbors. But I will, you know, rub one pointy finger with the other at you. Shame on anyone in this country who supports their government's so-called authority to torture people. You know, that kind of thing it's just going to come back on the rest of us. You can't empower your government to be a torturer, you know, by definition, walking impunity, and think that you're going to somehow get away scot-free and no one's ever going to mess with you because you're not doing anything wrong. That's not really how totalitarian societies work, that you can just do what you want. And you can't create a totalitarian society and think it's going to affect everybody but you. I can't believe anybody has to even have this argument in this country. I have to have this argument with any of y'all? I don't think so. Come on. You guys all know. But there's somebody, there are people in this country still who will defend the government's so-called right to torture people. And, you know, I guess that's really a really good segue there. Sorry for my stuttering. I'm kind of discombobulated and doing too many things at once. That's a good segue into Lou Rockwell's article today at lourockwell.com. Two threats to liberty, the left and the right. I recommend anybody wants to understand the libertarian perspective, you just pull up lourockwell.com today and read that speech given by Lou Rockwell at the Future Freedom Foundation conference that took place this last weekend. And he explains it very well, that liberals and conservatives have this belief that society would just fall apart, it would be evil, it would be unfair, it would be terrible, it would be chaos, it would be something other than what they want if we didn't have an overwhelming, all-powerful government in D.C. to keep everything the way they want it. And of course, neither side is ever happy with the way things are. It's a never-ending struggle to pass more laws and take more liberty away from more people. Because liberals and conservatives both nowadays believe that society by itself, left alone, is chaos and death and mayhem. And that it's government that prevents it. I don't believe that that's true. And Lou Rockwell doesn't believe that that's true. And he makes the case that that's not true. That it's the state and people fighting over the state that causes most of the problems. Causes most of the violence. whereas free people can tend to work things out themselves. This is the old liberal idea. This is liberalism before Marx. And it's a great article. So everybody check that out at lourockwell.com. The left and right. Two paths to a total state. And let's see, I did the Soviet torture techniques and how they're exactly like the American ones. And speaking of Russia, let's go ahead and get to Pat Buchanan's article here. And you know, I never thought I would be the kind of guy who would sit on the radio and read Pat Buchanan articles. Jeez whiz. But I think this is really important. For those of you who are not too familiar with Pat Buchanan, he was a Nixon speechwriter, and to this day defends the wonderful Vietnam War, although I've heard him say some pretty contradictory things about it, basically admitting that it actually was unwinnable and so forth. But for the most part, Pat Buchanan is a hardcore right wing. He's a Catholic. He's not like a born-again crazy who wants to blow up the whole world to force Jesus to come back or anything. But he's right-wing, he's protectionist, you know, wants all kinds of tariffs and trade restrictions and that kind of thing. Very conservative guy, you know, anti-abortion and all that kind of stuff. Hardcore Cold Warrior. And no regrets. At all. But another thing about Pat Buchanan is that when the Cold War ended, he wanted NATO to dissolve, disband, and the troops to come home. He believed that the only reason we set up this massive permanent military state and centralized state in this country was to protect us from the Russians. Now that the Soviet Union had fallen apart, it was time for America to go back to being a republic, not an empire. That's what he thought. He opposed the first Gulf War, which I didn't even know at the time that Pat Buchanan, I just assumed that he was a warmonger, but I guess I wasn't paying attention. I was only in, like, what, ninth grade? But anyway, he opposed the first Gulf War, and he opposed all the Clinton's wars in the 90s, and he has steadfastly opposed Bush's adventures beyond Afghanistan, and I don't even believe he really supported regime change in Afghanistan, although that may not be right. But in any case, he's certainly against the Iraq War. He created the American Conservative magazine in 2002 in order to oppose the Iraq War from its pages. And so I tell you all that to tell you this. When Pat Buchanan, Nixon speechwriter, proud Cold Warrior, American nationalist, protectionist, conservative, is giving you the straight dope about Russia and telling you that it's your government that's causing the problems and we need to leave those Russians alone, I think we need to listen very closely to that. Because Pat Buchanan, one, is a guy who understands Russia very much, and two, is the kind of guy who, you know, if it hadn't been Nixon, Pat Buchanan could have gone to China, I guess, and opened up trade relations with Mao. Not that he would have, but there should be no doubt that, you know, Pat Buchanan is not soft on Russia. Okay, we know where Pat Buchanan's coming from when it comes to Russia, and if he can possibly perceive them as a threat, we know that he will, right? That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, so here's what Pat Buchanan wrote about Russia today on antiwar.com. Who lost Russia? By 1988, Ronald Reagan, who had famously branded the Soviet Union an evil empire, was striding through Red Square arm in arm with Mikhail Gorbachev. Russians were pounding both men on the back. They had just signed the greatest arms reduction agreement in history, eliminating all Soviet SS-20s targeted on Europe, in return for removal of the Pershing and cruise missiles Reagan had deployed in Europe. Quote, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven," wrote Wordsworth about his first hearing the news of the fall of the Bastille. Many of us felt that way then. Within 3 years, the Berlin Wall had come down. The puppet regimes of Eastern Europe had been swept away. Germany was reunited. The Red Army had gone home. The Soviet Empire had vanished, and the Soviet Union had broken up into 15 nations. The Baltic republics were free. Ukraine was free. Yet on the eve of the G8 summit, Vladimir Putin has announced that Russia will retarget missiles on NATO. "We must," he said, "counter Bush's decision to put anti-missile missiles in Poland and radars in the Czech Republic." Why are we doing this? The United States says the ABM system in Europe is to defend against an Iranian attack, but Tehran has no atom bomb and no ICBM. That's intercontinental ballistic missile. We appear to be headed for a second Cold War, and, if we are, responsibility will not fully rest with the Kremlin, for among those who have mismanaged the relationship are Presidents Clinton and Bush II, the baby boomers who appeared to have kicked away the fruits of a Cold War victory won by their greatest generation predecessors. Okay, give me a break. See, just that ought to remind you who we're dealing with here, right? This is Pat defending the Soviet Union now. How did they do it? How did Bush and Clinton screw up everything? This is the question. When the Red Army went home from Eastern Europe, the United States, in violation of an understanding with Moscow, began to move NATO east. We have since brought into our military alliance 6 former members of the Warsaw Pact and 3 former provinces of the Soviet Union, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. 2, anti-Russian hawks are now pushing to bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. If they succeed, we could be dragged into future confrontations with a nuclear-armed Russia about who has sovereignty over the Crimea and whether South Ossetia should be part of Georgia. Are these vital U.S. interests worth risking a war? Why are we moving a U.S.-led military alliance into the front yard and onto the side porch of a country with thousands of nuclear weapons? Would we accept any consummate Chinese or Russian move in the Caribbean? After Moscow gave us a green light to use the former Soviet republics of Central Asia to base U.S. forces for the Afghan war, the United States has sought permanent bases there. Russia and China have now united to throw us out of their backyard. Yeah, that's good, George Bush. You just undo that Sino-Soviet split as best you can there, buddy. America colluded with Azerbaijan and Georgia to build a Baku-Tbilisi-Siam pipeline to transmit Caspian Sea oil across the Caucasus to the Black Sea and Turkey, cutting Russia out of the action. In 1999, the United States bombed Serbia for 78 days to punish it for fighting to hold its cradle province of Kosovo, which Albanian Muslims were tearing away. Orthodox Russia had long seen itself as a protectress of the Balkan Slavs. That Clinton ignored Russia in launching this unprovoked war on Serbia was seen in Moscow as proof that Russian concerns had become irrelevant in Washington. And after helping dump over the government in Belgrade, our neo-Comintern, the National Endowment for Democracy, Freedom House, and other fronts interfered in Ukraine and Georgia, helping oust pro-Moscow regimes and installing pro-American ones. Since then, NED has been run out of Belarus, and its subsidiaries are about to get the boot from Moscow. Can we blame the Russians for being angry? How would we react to left-wing NGOs in Washington flush with Moscow oil money, aiding elements hostile to the Bush administration? The United States has been constantly hectoring Russia on backsliding from democracy, but compared to Beijing, Moscow is Montpelier, Virginia. And why, if the Cold War is over, are Russia's political arrangements any of our business? If we don't like the way Putin treats Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Boris Berezovsky, and other oligarchs who robbed Russia blind in the 1990s, maybe Putin doesn't like how we treated Martha Stewart. Harry Truman is often blamed for having started the Cold War. He didn't, Pat claims, but yeah, he did. But Clinton, George W., and the neocons have a strong claim to having started the second. A first order of business of the next president should be to repair the damage this crowd has done and to get out of Russia's face. So anyway, I'm sorry, I was kind of disjointed, but would you dig that? Pat Buchanan arguing again, and I've talked about this before on this show, again, Pat Buchanan arguing the case for the Russians. Hey, America, leave the Russians alone. What the hell are you doing, Dick Cheney? Stop it. Trying to start another Cold War? We don't have enough enemies? We haven't lost enough of our liberty, enough American lives yet? We got to pick a fight with the Russians? 646-6446, 512-646-6446 if you're calling from out of town. Sorry, I really need to get a 1-800 number, don't I? I keep forgetting to do that. But, you know, cell phones, free long distance there. 512-646-6446. And I really don't know for sure what this means, folks. But Hamdan's case has been thrown out by a military judge. Now, you might remember the Hamdan case. The Supreme Court ruled that... Basically, that Bush was a criminal, that he had been kidnapping and torturing people outside of the law for years and years and years, and that the Constitution does not grant him the authority to make up the law however he likes and kidnap and torture and murder people in secret prisons and so forth. And they said to President Bush, look, the Constitution says this power belongs to the Congress. They are the ones who make laws concerning war and how prisoners are to be treated, etc. So, if you want to kidnap and murder and torture people, Mr. Bush, you have to go to the Congress. And that's what he did, and that was the Military Commissions Act of 2006. This was Bush complaining about the Supreme Court decision right after they made it.
And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague.
Yeah, poor guy. It's very vague. And of course, the reason the Geneva Convention is vague, well, in a sense, it's not vague. In a sense, what it's saying is, hey, look, you can't mistreat people, pal. You have to treat them with respect. That's pretty cut and dry. It mandates treating people with basic human decency. But on the other hand, it is vague, in a sense, because they deliberately made it that way so that the average guy, you know, fighting a war, taking a prisoner, is going to think back to that definition and think, well, geez, anything could fall under that, and therefore treat people with respect. Bush's problem is he wants to be able to torture people this way, but not that way. You know, rip out their fingernails, but not put screws in their thumbs. You know, that kind of thing. So that's his problem with common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. It's very vague. It says we can't really torture them at all, not even if we do it this way or that way, which is what we want to do. Boo-hoo. But now, in the Hamdan case, this is the guy who's accused of being Osama bin Laden's driver. His case, and also Omar Khadr, a Canadian captured in a firefight in Afghanistan at age 15. Both of the cases, the military tribunal cases against these two, have been thrown out. And I'm not certain what this really means. But the Reuters headline says Guantanamo war crimes trial screeched to halt. I have to get Jacob Hornberger or somebody on to explain to me what the hell this means legally, but I'll go ahead and read you what Reuters has so far. Guantanamo Bay, U.S. Naval Base, Cuba, June 4th, Reuters. U.S. military judges dropped all war crimes charges on Monday against the only two Guantanamo captives facing trial, rulings that could preclude trying any of the 380 prisoners held at the U.S. base in Cuba anytime soon. The judges said they lacked jurisdiction under the strict definition of those eligible for trial by a military tribunal under a law the U.S. Congress enacted last year. It's another demonstration that the system simply doesn't work, said the tribunal's chief defense counsel, Marine Colonel Dwight Sullivan. So, what the hell? Does that mean some wily member of the Imperial Senate deliberately altered the language in such a way that everybody would think that this meant George Bush could continue going on ahead, and yet by the time it would get to the judges that they would find that they didn't really have authority? I mean, we're talking about the military judges at the military tribunal in Guantanamo saying that they don't have jurisdiction in this case? Does that mean they're going to have to rewrite the Military Commissions Act and start over again? Or that they'll have to actually give trials or at least prisoner of war status to the people illegally being held? It's another demonstration that the system simply doesn't work, said the tribunal's chief defense counsel, Marine Colonel Dwight Sullivan. The rulings did not affect U.S. authority to indefinitely hold the 380 foreign terrorism suspects detained at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in southeast Cuba, but it was the latest setback for the Bush administration's effort to put the Guantanamo captives through some form of judicial process. It was forced to rewrite the rules last year after the U.S. Supreme Court deemed the old tribunals illegal. Charges were dropped for Omar Khadr, a Canadian captured in a firefight in Afghanistan at age 15. Khadr, now 20, was accused of killing a U.S. soldier with a grenade and wounding another in a battle at a suspected Al-Qaeda compound in Afghanistan in 2002. Charges were also dropped for Salim Ahmed Hamdan of Yemen, who is accused of driving and guarding Osama bin Laden. Hamdan last year won a U.S. Supreme Court challenge that scrapped the first Guantanamo tribunal system. Both have been charged with conspiracy and providing material support for terrorism. Khadr also faced charges of murder, attempted murder, and spying, the latter for allegedly conducting surveillance of U.S. military convoys in Afghanistan. Hamdan still hopes for fair trial, says his attorney. Both defendants have been declared enemy combatants during administrative hearings begun at Guantanamo in 2004 to determine if there were grounds to continue holding them. But the judge for Hamdan's case, Navy Captain Keith Allred, said that definition was broad enough to include captives who supported the Taliban or Al-Qaeda without actually engaging in combat. He said the Military Commissions Act, adopted by the U.S. Congress in 2006, set more stringent rules and allowed only those designated as unlawful enemy combatants to face trial in the Guantanamo tribunals. Allred said that the law limited the tribunal's jurisdiction to those who have actually engaged in hostilities. No Guantanamo captives have been formally designated as unlawful enemy combatants, and defense lawyers said none could be tried unless they first faced proceedings reclassifying them as such. Yeah, that's the American way, right? Change the law after the fact. That's how we play football, right? And basketball. Hey, guys, let's change the rules in the middle of the game so that that point I just scored will count. Please? Isn't that the American way? Isn't that how we do things? Hamdan was relieved and, quote, still hopes he's going to get a fair trial, said his military lawyer, Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift. A Pentagon spokeswoman, Army Major Beth Kubala, said it would be speculative to draw conclusions about the future of the tribunal system. She called the tribunals fair, transparent, and legitimate. Shame on her and all of her family. And sorry, I guess I do believe in collective guilt sometimes. And said the rulings demonstrated that, quote, the military judges operate independently. Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's what this proves, is that the system is actually very fair. Allred and the judge in the Khadr case, Army Colonel Peter Brownback, left open the possibility of refiling charges against the two defendants if they were reclassified. But defense lawyers and rights groups said that any trial should be moved to the regular U.S. federal court system or the long-established court-martial system. Quote, at this point, detainees have been more successful committing suicide in Guantanamo than the government has been successful in getting detainees to trial, Amnesty International observer Jumana Musa said. Four prisoners have committed suicide at Guantanamo since the detention and interrogation camp opened in 2002. So we'll see where this goes. Looks pretty good to me. I remember, I guess about a year ago, maybe a little more than that, there were a couple of prosecutors, maybe a whole handful of prosecutors who resigned rather than participate in these show trials. I remember one of them, his name was Carr, with two R's on the end. And he said, no, I'm sorry, I have dignity. And I will not be part of this. The Constitution ain't perfect, but it's got some built-in safeguards. And, I will argue, I have argued, and I will continue to argue. And in fact, I'm arguing right now that many of those have failed to work the way they're supposed to work. And really, we're way past the point of abandoning the U.S. Constitution at this point now. As Lysander Spooner said back in, 1866 or 1867, he said the U.S. Constitution has either created this situation as we have had or has been unable to prevent it. In either case, it is unfit to exist. And I tend to go along with that. But on the other hand, I don't know if we're all the way. It's funny. I don't know. Some of these stories about Dick Cheney coming out, maybe this is too late to say. But I don't think we're completely a banana republic yet. I don't think the Constitution is completely overthrown yet. And I don't think the American people are so dull yet that they're willing to just completely abandon what was ever good about our system. I hope that's right. I should play y'all a song. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And, I only got 10 minutes left. I'll play y'all a song in a minute. I'll talk more news stories now. 108 dead in Lebanon. We talked about America as Larissa Alexandrovna called it treason. I don't know what else you call it. America backing Al-Qaeda in Lebanon, ostensibly to fight against Hezbollah, even though now this group, Fatah al-Islam, which is basically Al-Qaeda in Lebanon, already joined up with Hezbollah and blowing up in the face of the Sonora puppet government there. I'm trying to arrange an interview, actually, with a fan of the show who lives in Beirut. See if he can give us a little bit of a lowdown about what's going on in Lebanon. Also, I should point you guys to the spotlight on antiwar.com today. You heard me making fun of the JFK plot on the show yesterday, and you can read what I wrote about it on the antiwar.com blog. But here at the Huffington Post, this lady, Nora Ephron, who I know nothing about, so, you know, I don't know, but I like this article. She says, in order to foil a terrorist plot, you must first find a terrorist plot. This is not easy. Not just anyone can find and then foil a terrorist plot. You must have an incentive. The best incentive is to be an accused felon looking at a long prison term. Under such circumstances, your lawyer will explain to you. You may even be able to reduce your sentence by acting as an informant in a criminal case, preferably one involving terrorists. The fact that you do not know any actual terrorists should not in any way deter you. Necessity is the mother of invention. If you can find the right raw material, a sad, sick, lonely, drunk, deranged, disgruntled, or just plain anti-American Muslim somewhere in the United States, you can make your very own terrorist. Now the good part begins. Money. The FBI will give you lots of money to take your very own terrorist to lots of dinners, where you, wearing a wire, can record yourself making recommendations to him about possible targets and weapons that might be used in impending terrorist attack that your very own terrorist is going to mastermind with your help. It will even buy you a computer so you can go to Google Earth in order to show your very own terrorist a top secret aerial image of the target you have suggested. More money! The FBI will give you even more money to travel to foreign countries with your very own terrorist and will make suggestions about terrorist groups you can meet while in said foreign countries. Number 6. Months and even years will pass in this fashion while you essentially get the FBI to pay for everything you do. Incidentally, be sure your lawyer negotiates your expense account well in advance, or you may be forced, as the informant was in the Buffalo terrorist case, to protest your inadequate remuneration by setting yourself on fire in front of the White House. At a certain point, something will go wrong. You may have trouble recruiting other people to collaborate with your very own terrorist, who is, as you yourself know, just an ordinary guy in a really bad mood. Or alternatively, the terrorist cell you have carefully cobbled together may malfunction and fail to move forward, probably as a result of sheer incompetence or simply not having been genuinely serious about the acts of terrorism you were urging it to commit. At this point, you may worry that the FBI is going to realize that there isn't much of a terrorist plot going on here at all. Just a case of entrapment. Do not despair. The FBI is way ahead of you. The FBI knows perfectly well what's going on. The FBI has as much at stake as you do. So before it can be obvious to the world there's no case, the FBI will arrest your very own terrorist, hold a press conference, and announce that a huge terrorist plot has been foiled. It will, of course, be forced to admit that this plot did not proceed beyond the pre-planning stages, that no actual weapons or money were involved, that the plot itself was not technically feasible, but that it will not stop the story, from becoming a front-page episode all over America, and within hours, boilerplate for all the Republican politicians who believe that you need to arrest a homegrown terrorist now, and then to justify the continuing war in Iraq. Everyone will be happy, except for the schmuck you schmickled into becoming a terrorist, and no one really cares about him anyway. So congratulations, you have foiled a terrorist plot. Way to go. That was great. Nora Ephron, good for you, lady. She's exactly right. All these terrorist plots, bunch of bogus crap. Moving on, Jim Loeb has an article spotlighted. It's right there at the top of the page in the highlight section today at antiwar.com, reviewing polling data. Surprise! Or, okay, this shouldn't be surprising at all if you keep up. U.S. Arabs, Jews, share peace goals. That's right, overwhelming majorities of Arabs and Jews in the United States agree that there ought to be a peaceful settlement, you know, involving giving up the West Bank and Gaza and so forth. Going back to the pre-67 war borders. You may be surprised, you shouldn't be, but you may be surprised to know that of all ethnic groups in America, Jews are the most opposed to Bush's foreign policy, and have been all along. So, you know, don't ever let anybody tell you that those who criticize the neocons, and those who criticize the Israel lobby, and those who criticize the Kadima slash Likud government in Israel are somehow anti-Semitic. Because the fact of the matter is the vast majority of American Jews and a substantial number, if not a majority, of Israeli Jews agree with us that the war party's policies are nothing but danger to Israel and to the United States. So 70-something percent, 77%, I think it was, of American Jews oppose the current occupation of Iraq. So, I always love Jim Loeb. He does great analysis when the polls come out. Always love reading Jim Loeb. That's antiwar.com/Loeb. And Arthur Silber has another great one today on his blog. If you look at the anti-war blog, we'll need free health care to survive 4 years of her by Matt Barganier. And he links to Arthur Silber's blog, The Power of Narrative. Some races are just not as good as others. And check out this quote from Hillary Clinton in the debate just the other night. Our troops did the job they were asked to do. They got rid of Saddam Hussein. They conducted the search for weapons of mass destruction. They gave the Iraqi people a chance for elections and to have a government. It is the Iraqis who have failed to take advantage of that opportunity. That's Hillary Clinton. And I like this because Arthur Silber, of course, goes back in history to quote Senator Albert Beveridge, January 1900, it would be better to abandon this combined garden and Gibraltar of the Pacific, the Philippines, than to apply any academic arrangement of self-government to these children. They are not capable of self-government. How could they be? They are not a self-governing race. What alchemy will change the oriental quality of their blood and set the self-governing currents of the American pouring through their Malay veins? How shall they, in the twinkling of an eye, be raised to the heights of self-governing people, which required 1,000 years for us to reach, Anglo-Saxon though we are? And Arthur goes on sarcastically, saying, yeah, you're right. It has, the fact that in both cases, in the war in the Philippines 100 years ago and the war in Iraq now, it doesn't matter that Americans have been going around killing hundreds of thousands of people, blowing things up, marginalizing any sort of moderate or intellectual or middle class influence, and encouraging the crazies on all sides. Oh no, the problem is just those weak, inferior Arabs. Hillary Clinton, Little Miss Politically Correct, the fascist in the pink dress, letting it be exactly known whose fault it is that Iraq has gone so badly. Quote, it is the Iraqis who have failed to take advantage of the opportunity that we have given them, says Hillary Clinton. It's the Iraqis' fault. And if you want to read, you know, basically the exact same sentiment, well, all you have to do is read Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. He'll tell you the same thing. Screw you, Iraqis. You deserve the hell on earth that you've created for yourselves over there. Yeah. Yeah, Hillary Clinton, Charles Krauthammer, no responsibility whatsoever do they bear. Of course not. So, there you go. Hillary Clinton now encompassing all facets of fascism. She is officially a racist bigot who considers herself superior to Arabs and them to be savages. Thank you, Hillary, for completing my caricature of you as an American Nazi on the order of, say, Rudolph Giuliani. Appreciate that. And that's it. I'm all out of time. It's 1 o'clock. Hey, everybody, watch Ron Paul, the debate tonight on CNN, third Republican debate. Here's some Turbo Negro. See y'all here tomorrow, 11 to 1, Texas time.
Children than died in Hiroshima. And